listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we discuss some of the contemporary political issues with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia. I guess we could start with the activity that took place earlier this week. We've been seeing volatility in various stock markets over the last month or two, and then we had what happened with the S&P index earlier this week. And, you know, the sort of background drama, you know, shouts back and forth between Washington and Beijing over trade and this... thing over the Huawei and Iran sanctions and all of that. So let's start there.
Yeah, I think the S&P drop, the largest one-day drop in its history, although as the a lot of analysts of the markets say, it was only a very small part of the stock markets that really showed a decline. But What I think is most significant is that this has been going on over several weeks now, and we read today in the financial papers that that once again stocks on a global scale are falling, and so and everyone says that this decline, it's not just volatility, it's decline. This decline is the result of uncertainty. And the uncertainty is about a whole number of things. Of course, the China-U.S. Trade war, tariff wars, some of that was cooled out a little bit last week in Argentina between Trump and Xi Jinping. But I think the larger thing is that the political uncertainty, be it the political meltdown in Britain, the political and street battles in Paris and throughout France.
Yeah.
Really political meltdown in Germany. Angela Merkel is on her way out. We don't know how long she will survive. She was the center of stability in Europe, the leader of Europe, as Trump withdrew from any commitment to the European Union. In fact, saw them as a competitor and almost hostile adversary in economic and trade matters. And as the U.S. under Trump has been withdrawing from Europe, they thought that Merkel and Macron of France would be the center of stability. Now Macron is on his way down. I think his polling numbers are in the low 20s, if not below 20%. And then, of course, Italy, a major economy in Europe. The government there is a anti-neoliberal government that is in the process of violating all of the rules of EU membership, especially in terms of debt, percentage of debt to GNP or GDP. So I think that political uncertainty, and then you add to that in the United States, the decline in housing prices, the rise of interest rates, and the tax cuts that were instituted in 2017 are now wearing off, and that's no longer able to stimulate the economy. Right. And the normal 10-year process of boom and bust, the normal economic cycle of capitalist economies, is inserting itself in the economies, especially of the United States. But I think the slowdown of the global economy, including China, and not so much India, but China and all of the major European countries, I think we're looking at a global recession definitely by 2020 at the latest, but probably in 2019, which will add to the political chaos. And so we're in a very difficult moment. The elites politically cannot govern in the old way. The people will not be governed in the old way.
Right.
The question is, how will all of this end?
Yeah, the question is, what does come? Yeah, I'm looking at a chart of the S&P going back to 1998, and when it was in on say January 17th of 97, it was at 776.17. Today it's at 2700.06, we're at close yesterday, I guess, and closed the day before yesterday because yesterday was a holiday, national day of mourning, I'm looking at in Election Day 2016, it was just shy of 2100. Mm-hmm. It peaked at about 29.5 over the last month or so, dropped down to 2600 and is at 27 today. And so, you know, we're not talking about a collapse in any event. You know, it's still at a record high with the exception of the last 90 days.
What we're talking about is a trend.
Generally, that's correct.
Yeah. And trend is more important at this time than any other measure of anything.
Right, because the change in trend is you had almost a straight line up since the last correction, quote unquote, and now you have up, down, up, down, up, down as it seeks to find level. So that's already a change in the trend from climb to adjustment, and that, of course, signifies either some trauma that, you know, it's reacting to, or something more fundamental, and most likely it's the latter. Now, the timing from the point of view of Trump couldn't be better. If this was going to come, it came after the midterms. He did pretty well in the midterms. So almost immediately after the midterms that we've got time to settle it before the 2020 elections, as much time as you would be allowed. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's almost the whole full 2 years. So there's that. I mean, this, all of this depends on exactly what are we seeing. Is this going to be, you know, another, say, qualitative change in the nature of the collapse? Mm-hmm. You know, which, I mean, I think we're seeing trend, you know, a trend towards that. Even as these markets climb, they signify, in a way, a greater collapse, because stocks and other financial instruments are becoming more and more the only place to invest as the real economy shrinks mm-hmm. in many ways.
Right.
And opportunities right. for investment shrink. You know, we've seen mm-hmm. manifestations of that with all the money that's been parked overseas and everywhere else, the incentives that were given to repatriate that money. And when it comes home, it's still a problem. Well, where do we invest it where we can get a return on it? Mm-hmm. You know, you have these mm-hmm. fundamental economic problems that, you know, Marx was describing in the 1840s that still mm-hmm. haven't been resolved, and they've mm-hmm. you know, just intensified. So you've got that background to all of this. A political condition, as you described, and I think, you know, the avant of that is what we're seeing on the streets of France and the former French colonies, you know, the mm-hmm. Franco world, because mm-hmm. that's spreading throughout the French-speaking mm-hmm. world.
Mm-hmm.
And other manifestations of it, as you described, particularly in Italy, where they elected an anti-neoliberal mm-hmm. government,
mm-hmm.
And where it's diverging. It's an interesting phenomenon, because you have, on the one hand, description and an accurate one in many ways for the reaction to the EU from these different member nations as being a right-wing response. The mm-hmm. violations of the you know, economic rules are actually left-wing responses, mm-hmm. like over debt, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I very, very much agree with what you're saying. If we could just for a moment focus upon the United States and Trump.
Yeah.
Trump will not be able, and none of the elites, on the terms of the U.S. Political economy and mode of governing, no one among the elites will be able to hold back the tide of anger and resistance. This will only grow.
Right.
Trump, for the moment, is the instrument, political instrument, of the anti-establishment masses. And they are growing, by the way. Mm. And for this reason, you see a growth, at least according to polls, in Trump's support among African Americans. And this is highly significant. I think perhaps as significant as Trump's victory itself. African Americans, in many different ways, abandoning the Democratic Party. We saw it in Florida,
yeah.
The gubernatorial race in Florida with Andrew Gillum's. We saw it in Georgia with the gubernatorial candidacy of Stacey Abrams.
Yeah.
And what did we see? I mean, both were on track to win. But what sunk them in their close races were, one, the numbers of blacks that voted for the Republican candidate, be they white, and the great number of blacks who did not vote at all.
Right.
Which, you know, kind of was the margin of victory. Now, I raise that to say that the anger and alienation of the working class and poor and parts of the lower middle class are at such a fever pitch that literally at some point the masses are going to be calling for a radical change in the nature of the economic system and of the modes of governance of the country. I think we're close to that. And you're right. What is going on in France and in Paris may represent the future, not only of the United States, and I think we're not, you know, we can pretty much predict that will happen. But of England, of other countries in the advanced capitalist world, I think we're in a state of ungovernability, a crisis of legitimacy of the system. When we talked some weeks ago about the collapse of the vital center, you know, Arthur Schlesinger, the historian's concept of the vital center must hold if the system is to be governed. The vital center has collapsed. And what is driving the collapse is the anger of the working people, of black folk, of all of those who have not seen an increase in wages, a standard of living for 40 years, of the growing poverty, of the growing depression. You know, where again, in 2017, for the third year straight, the American life expectancy declined, and the center of the decline were white people without high school education, which is, I mean, without college educations, which means the working class, the white working class, who are dying from suicides and drug overdoses. These are measures of a growing sense of hopelessness and giving up on the system. The question is to transform the despair into resistance and struggle. So, yeah, that's what I don't think there is. That will not end. It can only grow. Trump could lose the next election and it will continue to grow.
Yeah, or win it.
Yeah, and it will continue. That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it seems almost irrelevant to the point because the solutions that really need to be actualized to these problems are not going to be voted into office on anyone's back.
No.
And and until those problems are solved, they're going to continue to manifest.
Yeah. And you know, and that's what so many people missed after 2016. You know, this smearing of all the white working people and all the white poor as racist, damn near Ku Klux Klan members, and on and on and on, was a way of dismissing them and saying that the Trump election was really an anomaly, and we have to get back to a form of, quote, liberal democracy, and the left participated with the neoliberal elite, and of course the deep state, including the FBI and CIA and the rest of them, right, in fighting to get back to what they considered normal.
Right.
We're not going to be back to normal.
No,
the left,
not normal.
What calls itself the left, was completely wrong, had nothing to say to the great mass of people, are not connected to them, by the way.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's what we're looking at.
Right.
And we have to look it dead in the face and not be afraid of it.
Yeah.
This is the way the systemic breakdown is going to happen in the United States and throughout the capitalist world.
That's right. This is what it looks like.
This is what it looks like.
Well, you know, so we've had, I mean, we'll go to France for a moment, just because it seems to be so, mm-hmm. you know, further developed in a way, you know, like more matured in a way to where it's actually mm-hmm. in the streets at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You go back over the history of France, you know, people forget that there have been these uprisings, revolutions, even in Europe, with the working class, you know, which was much more highly developed in Europe than it was in the United States in the 19th century, you know, leading a lot of it. You had in France alone, you had the 1789 revolution, the Paris Commune in 1871, the, you know, first socialist revolution in Europe, really. And then Vichy in 1940 and what happened in 1968. And mm-hmm. in each case, you had like this thunderous activity on the ground and then a resolution of it through the society that ended up leading where we are now, putting the same mm-hmm. you know, powers back in power, in essence.
Mm-hmm.
There's a history of how that happened, both the inside history by the people that were able to manipulate events back then that still know that and haven't necessarily shared all of that information with the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And of course, there is the, you know, science of social control that has mm-hmm. evolved and is now plugged into supercomputers and data points on every human being mm-hmm. on the planet. And that is who will be manipulating events in the defense of the order in France, Italy, wherever else this breaks out as it breaks out, with a global view of the whole thing and an atomic set of data, you know, all the way down to the individual. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, I wonder if any of us even know that there's a game board on our side.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult battle to conduct when the sides are so lopsided.
Well, you know, the other thing is how one understands history. Yeah. Because, you know, in moments like this, history becomes a real useful tool in our understanding of the present and future. You know, you're right about the rise of the class conflict over at least 250 years in Europe. And we could go back a little earlier, perhaps. But, you know, this trajectory. And I think the key moment is World War II. Maybe we could say that whole period of World War I to the end of World War II with the Great Depression in between there. And then Europe rebuilds itself and new forms of rule and governance are locked in. A big section of the European working class is bought off. That's the purpose of neocolonialism. And a certain way, for a while, the capitalist ruling classes of Europe and America shared some of their profits, especially those that come from the super exploitation of the colonial world, shared that with parts of the working class. And so, you know, you get this idea of the middle class as a replacement to the working class and such. But now that has come to an end. There's no more to share. And the other thing is the 1% and 1/10 of 1% became even more greedy.
Right.
And they saw even more reckless ways to make billions and almost trillions of dollars. So they financialized everything. And and the work of producing things was exported to China and Vietnam and the Philippines and parts of Africa and on and on and on. And then, of course, all of the coups and wars, ethnic and other kind of wars in Africa, stoked and financed by the West so that they could maintain control of the resources of Africa and to keep them cheap. But this is coming to an end. And it's ironic that the great challenge to it is now in the centers of world capitalism, not on what was often called the periphery in the colonial or third world. I think, and so we have to consider a collapse, but then the possibility of prolonged chaos in the major capitalist countries where there are political and other kinds of battles of every imaginable sort taking place. France is one example. But, you know, the street violence will probably cool out, but that doesn't resolve the political crises.
Right.
England is the same thing. I mean, England is in a political meltdown, and so is the United States. So this is what we're looking at.
Right. Yeah, if you look at Paris, for example, okay, so it's December. It's going to be winter in a week or two. And so everybody goes indoors and, you know, does that for the next few months. And then in spring, you have a resurgence of what had happened. It'll be, you know, 51 years in this spring from the Paris spring of 1968. And so that now people have been organizing since then. The problems that gave rise to the, you know, that fueled the uprising this time continue to percolate. The conditions of people is more difficult rather than less. I mean, this was, the spark for this was actually prospective you know, a tax about to be imposed that is now, you know, off the table for a while,
right,
as opposed to something that had already been suffered and endured by people, which is somehow cured. The actual fuel for this are the things, of course, that have been suffered by people for a long time, with the austerity that's been imposed on Europe for a long time. And that condition is only going to continue to deteriorate. No one's addressed that at all.
No, this is it. And each country will have its own form of political chaos and meltdown. The United States will be the unique place because the American social and political economies are very different, very peculiar, because of the history of chattel slavery and the ongoing history of black oppression, the ongoing reality of black oppression, which, you know, you have...
It's an internal version of what you described with the colonial period externally in Europe.
Absolutely. And you have this black proletariat, which exists in two worlds, both the black world and the third world, as they call it, and as a part of the American working class itself.
Right.
So it channels through itself a unique consciousness, which if it influences growing sections of the white working class, can create a very, very specific, peculiar, unique form of resistance. But it, I think, if I were to put a theoretical analysis on it, political theoretical analysis, I would say that going forward, from the standpoint of the masses and of the working class, almost everything depends upon what the black proletariat collectively does, because it can move the day. For example, on the immigration debate, the Democrats think they are using the immigration question against Trump, and that they will widen their electorate among Latinos and Hispanics, especially those from Mexico and Central America. But in the process, and recent polling data points this out, in the process, they are losing the black worker.
Right.
Because the black worker and poor are the principal victims of open borders and mass immigration.
Right.
They're the ones that lose jobs. And so they... And very interestingly also, are the Latino poor and working classes who do not agree with open borders. So the Democrats, say Kamala Harris, or from California, or Berto from Texas, the young guy that ran for Senate. You know, the thing is that if they think immigration is their path to electoral victory and to the presidency, they got it very wrong, because in the process, they are losing the most loyal part of the Democratic Party, and that is the black vote. And they are losing it rapidly. At least, you know, one poll, I think it was a Harvard-Harris poll, showed that 85% of black people polled said that they were for a cap upon legal immigration at 1 million a year. 54% said that they were for capping immigration to 250,000 a year or none.
Wow.
I mean, this dramatic shift away from the Democratic Party's orthodoxy and the appearance of liberalism is dramatic. I would even say that even if you take the so-called social democratic part of the Democratic Party, they do not have the loyalty of black people. We saw that with or the unconditioned loyalty of black people. I think that's partially what we saw in Florida with Andrew Gillum, who proclaimed himself a social democrat. There, black people have not yet found a party. They're moving away from the Democrats in dramatic numbers, which reshapes the whole electoral process and its future in the United States, and the future really of the two-party system.
So,
forgive me for talking too long. I'm sorry.
No. There's a lot. I'm trying to wrap my mind around something that we can encapsulate. We got about a minute and a half left, but because it's an excellent description and analysis of what what's going on right now. Mm-hmm. The response that keeps coming out of the Democratic Party seems like it gets churned out of the same ad agencies every time they have one of these electoral catastrophes. And I would say that that's what they've just endured again. They didn't get, they're going to be able to impeach Trump. That's about it. Not remove him, maybe impeach
Don,
him.
Yeah. Don, they have no message for the people. They are beholden to that part of the elite, the neoliberal, financial, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, Hollywood elite that are out of touch with the masses of the people.
Yeah, I would say it's not just messages. Yes, it's not just message. I think that for millions of people in the United States, they're not looking for a message. They're looking for some money to pay their bills, to pay their mortgage or their rent.
That's right.
They need food, they need health care, and they need relief for the educational debt, and they need that now. And the Democrats, nobody's offering that, with the possible exception, at least rhetorically, of Trump. And until that changes, nothing else is going to change. We got to stop there. So, Tony, I guess we can pick it up here next week unless something else happens between now and then. Thanks a lot for your time.
What I want to talk about is war and peace and the domestic politics.
Good. That's where we'll start next week. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, my brother. Peace.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. What does the rise of the Yellow Vest movement in France tell us about the state of the neoliberal order in Europe? Are the protests in France, the largest since 1968, just about a hike in fuel prices? And is Emmanuel Macron the right person to be president to address the problems so many have in France? Crosstalking France's Yellow Vest, I'm joined by my guest, Bruno Dawesky in Paris. He's a political analyst and a professor of National Institute of Languages and Eastern Civilizations. In Brussels, we have Luc Rivet. He's an independent journalist. And in Luxembourg, we cross to Louis Chevel. He is a professor at the University of Luxembourg. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate. Bruno, let me go to you first and address the first question I asked in my introduction. We all know, anyone's watching this program, the catalyst for these protests and this protest movement was an increase in fuel prices. But I think the larger picture is that this is a protest against neoliberal policies that working people, not just in France, but all across Europe, have had to deal with. I mean, this is the politics of austerity under the cover of dealing with global warming. The people are not so stupid to fall for that. Go ahead, Bruno.
Yes, of course. The miscontent is very began very long ago, but it was the last moment. I mean, it's a mixture of fuel prices with miscontent because of the arrogance of Macron. But of course, basically, it's against neoliberal policies that were carried on by Macron, Hollande earlier, and Sarkozy, and even earlier. So it's a general, insurrection against it, and that's why the concession the government did 2 days ago are just they have no sense because people want much more. They want a change in basic policies.
Okay, let me go to Luke in Brussels there. You were nodding your head. I mean, I thought the government's response was quite interesting, but it plays to a certain procedure, strategy they have. First, they say, well, you don't know what you're talking about. Listen to us. We're your leaders. Number two, oh, you must be these populist, which, of course, is a code word for neo-fascism. And then number three, they make a minor concession, but they don't want to have a discussion about it. I mean, every step of the way shows failure of leadership here, okay? And you haven't fooled these people because they understand that they have the real power. And why in the world should poor people have to pay for austerity? Austerity is making people poor. Go ahead, Luke.
Well, it's the last straw for these people. You know, they are the working French, the people who never complain and pay their taxes.
Yep.
But look at the number of people on the roundabout and look at who is there. Many women, single mothers with kids. They cannot feed their kids after the 20th of the month because they only earn 1,300 euro per month and they spend 300 in fuel. But there is more than just the fuel. Huh? There is also the gas prices that were supposed to go up for heating, and also electricity prices have gone up 500% over the last 5 years in France. So this is terrible, everything at the same time, and the price of the motorways, and. And what strikes me, as you say, is that in terms of communication, this team of Edouard Philippe and of President Macron is incredibly bad. Incredible. 3 weeks to come to that result saying, okay, yeah, you have won with suppressed attacks. Incredible.
Well, they haven't won. That's the wrinkle in all of this here. They've just postponed their decision. They have a lot more austerity planned. It's very, very clear what Macron wants to do. Okay, Louis, let me go to you in Luxembourg. I mean, how would you characterize this? A lot of people just say this is class struggle. I've mentioned that it is a putting neoliberalism on trial. What is it for you? And because the French have a tradition of street protests. It's a very rich tradition in France. But what is the difference, let's say, between 2018 and 1968? Go ahead, Louis.
Indeed, if you want, first, before interpretation in terms of politics, we have to describe the sociological reality. The sociological reality today is that in France you have a large middle class, lower middle class, that was very stable, almost privileged, and with stability of labor status, etc., 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 in the 1970s, 1980s, and it had been the result of the economic progression of the post-World War French situation. The middle class, the lower middle class today in the street, today in France, are the kids of a generation that have benefited from the economic boom of the so-called Trente Glorieuses, the 30 years after the Second World War. Now you have a backlash. You have a systematic backlash. You can say it's neoliberalism. You can say many, many different things. But simply the reality is that in the past, you have kids of poor who became rich. Yeah. Now you have a situation where the kids of the rich, of the okay, stable, relatively affluent middle class of the 1970s is now facing a backlash, economically speaking. The situation with Macron now is even worse, simply because there had been an economic bump, let's say, a kind of temporary recovery over the last 3 years, with many hopes of improvement. And the problem of Macron is that many, many people hoped from Macron a kind of new golden era. Now Macron is facing a backlash and he's facing a kind of aggregation of convergence and even more synchronization of frustrations, because he had been hosted like a kind of new De Gaulle 2 years ago.
New
and now he's facing
new De Gaulle. Okay.
about that.
That's a real stretch, a new De Gaulle. Okay, I was trained as a historian. He is no De Gaulle. Okay, let me go back to Bruno here. I mean, Macron, I mean, I watched the presidential campaign with great interest because I thought it was fascinating how the elites could invent this guy from virtually nowhere, sell him. The media backed him very, very much. They used the usual scare tactics with Madame Le Pen. And now we have their president, the elite's president, that is completely out of touch with the voters. And he's got a long way to go through his term in office. Yes, so Bruno, go ahead.
Yes, of course, the casting for Macron was technically very good. But
perfect.
You know, he destroyed all...
Perfect word, casting.
Yes, it's a casting. It was a pure casting. And, you know, just that they forgot that the real people voted for him, some of them at least, because he had not a strong majority, but at least he has a majority. They voted for him because they wanted the end of the traditional parties from the right or left who were who developed that neoliberal policies. And he was supposed to be a new man with a new, ideology. But in fact, he was chosen by the elite to accelerate the neoliberal policies. So it couldn't work. I mean, it worked for the first 2 months and then it finished. And people discovered they have somebody they call now on the street. It's a new king. It's not even a new king. It's a new Marie Antoinette. who completely ignores the real country.
Let them eat cake. Yes, indeed. Luke, reflect upon that because, I mean, he did come in making a lot of promises, but his promises weren't to the people. They were to the elites. So we see this creeping privatization of medicine, for example. And Louis was absolutely right. I mean, even into the 1980s, France had a lot to boast about its health care, of its population. That is no longer the case today. Go ahead, Luke.
True. The king is naked. And you mentioned, or somebody mentioned earlier, the fact that in the first few months it was okay. Well, he immediately introduced the ISF. It was one of the missions for which he had been selected, you know, to introduce the suppression of the tax on fortune, or the change of it only to on buildings, on the ownership of buildings. But the main bulk of the tax has been suppressed. France was one of the few countries to have this tax, if not the only one. It has suppressed it. But now the people, of course, the poor, when you ask them to pay much higher prices for their fuel, they make a comparison with last year, the ISF, the suppression of the tax on fortunes. So they cannot swallow it. It's at the same time. He loves to say that. You know, it's always at the same time. He gave money back to the rich and he took it from the poor. That doesn't work. You know, somebody should tell that young man that this is not the way forward.
Okay, Louis, let me go back to you here. I mean, there's been a lot of defections from Macron's government. I mean, is his government under threat right now? I mean, a lot of people apparently don't want to work with him.
Typically, you have a strong destabilization. At some point, I remember that regarding Obama, Vladimir Putin said something like, "The deepest disappointments come from excessive hopes."
Yes.
There had been excessive hopes on the side of Macron, and now we face the backlash. The problem is that Macron still have 3 years and a half theoretically to wait for the next elections, and it will be very difficult on these recent trends to find the energy to go to this target. The most important thing to underline now is that in France we are facing a relatively strong economic deceleration, in the sense that 2 years ago the economic conjuncture was much better. Now you have an economic slowdown, and people are relatively frightened of the consequences of that. We are already relatively strict or limited on cash at the state level in France, and which will be the result of a new recession.
Okay, Louis, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break, and after our break, we'll continue our discussion on the Yellow Vests. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Bruno in Paris. Okay, we've discussed this simmering revolt against the neoliberal order. One could even say elements of the architecture of the European Union. We can get to that later. But Bruno, one of the things I think is really quite fascinating is this. It was, and I'm convinced, I believe it, it was a spontaneous movement that came together. And I think the yellow vest metaphor is so brilliant because it's asking for help. Okay, you don't want to be run over because people feel like they're being run over. Now, but the interesting thing is here is that the trade unions didn't step up. The political parties didn't step up. It just took this last element, this, you know, this element of putting pressure, austerity on people for them to finally come together and find solidarity. Depending on how it goes, this is a fascinating phenomenon because the European Union in its neoliberal order doesn't like surprises. Everything is planned out to the last detail. This is not supposed to happen. Go ahead, Bruno.
Yeah, you're entirely right, you know, because they the success of European Union was to create the European Confederation of Trade Unions and all what they call the European parties. And this structure, financed by Brussels, corrupted every parties and trade unions and parties from the right and left. So they destroyed any potential opposition, real opposition to neoliberalism. And now there is something they couldn't plan that is happening. And what is very interesting is that now you have 80% of the French people who are against the government and its neoliberal policies. But what is even more interesting is the fact that it's not the traditional, let's say, opposition classes which are on the forefront of the fight. They support it, but they don't do more. What is very interesting is now in the arena are coming people from the the peripheral France. I mean the province, little towns, countryside, very young people, old people, people who never were active. And that was that part of France who is in fact joining the anti-neoliberal course. And that's very interesting. And I don't really imagine how the leading groups and classes will manage that for the next 3 years.
Yeah, well, the elites just apparently don't know or really don't care how everybody else lives here. Luke, President Macron said there is no such thing as French culture, saying that there's nationalism is wrong. I mean, what kind of French president is this? Something that wants to emulate de Gaulle. De Gaulle, for better or worse, embodied the greatest traditions of France, and of its entire history, I would say. So what kind of president of France says there's no French culture? I'm absolutely aghast by that comment. But it seems to me his way of rule is exactly that, okay? He doesn't care about France. Go ahead, Luke.
True. He'd like to be Jupiter, style of the goal, but he's not the goal. He doesn't have the respect of the people. And he has sort of left away the intermediate bodies, les corps intermédiaires. So there is nobody under him. He is there with Edouard Philippe's government, and they are on top of the Olymp, and they look at the French. So he had it vertical, completely vertical. There is nobody in between. The trade unions, as you said, are left behind. They are nowhere to be seen. He has sort of won against them with the railroads, the SNCF. But in this instance now, it is really a rebellion of the poor whites, just like for Donald Trump. You mentioned the populist earlier. Well, this is the same sort of phenomenon, you know?
Okay, Louis, where does it go here? Because historically speaking, when there is a spontaneous protest or uprising, the key to success is sustainability. Now, a lot of people have come out, put on their yellow vest, and they've made a statement, okay? But where does it go from here? Historically, a movement, a large movement that is not organized relatively quickly tends to fade away because people have had their burst of protest. But if it is not channeled somehow, my understanding is that these people, the protesters, are not interested in the political parties. They're not interested in the trade union stepping forward. They don't have a they don't trust any politicians right now. It's a very interesting mix right now. So my question is, where does it go from here? Go ahead, Louis in Luxembourg.
Indeed, the situation in France is that it's very different to 1968 mobilization. In this old good time, 30% of wage earners had their trade union membership, and the political parties were very, very strong at the end of De Gaulle and in the 15 years after De Gaulle. Nowadays, you have a kind of desertification of politics. You have a situation where trade unions are less than 5% of wage earners. And political parties are extremely weak, and even weaker with Macron, who has been able to kill Socialist Party, and the center-right wing is relatively weakened now with internal conflicts. So the situation today, technically speaking in sociology, we call that anomie. Anomie is a problem not only of governance, of decision. Anomie is the fact that people have lost strong structures they had before. And this anomic situation, you have problems of, you have said sustainability. Sometimes you have a new movement that developed pop-ups from nothing. The Yellow Vest movement was unexisting almost 2 months ago. And now you have a situation where they are obviously massively present in the place. What is sustainable is not the Yellow Vest movement. The sustainable thing is that you have a new French spirit of, let's say, destabilization, strong frustration, sense of anxiety regarding future. And in this respect, the situation is even more revolutionary than a simple anti-liberal policy situation. You have a situation where people don't really know where it's possible to go. The situation to do is the situation today, at this time, in the current period, is that the oil, the diesel tax had been excluded from the, it had been expelled from the framework.
What's really, let me jump in here. I think what's really fascinating, Bruno, is that right now, and of course you're much closer to the ground than I am, there is not a whole lot of organization. They're still articulating their demands on a much more macro scale. Of course, there's the energy prices, but you know this is leading to other things. But juxtaposition on the other side, you have a government that is paralyzed in how to react. Every step of the way, it has stumbled. And it does, at least to me, it doesn't look like the government has a learning curve to be able to interact with people to address these grievances. So you have a very strange dynamic going on right now, a government that seems paralyzed and a social movement. I don't even know if it's a social movement yet. This is where we're at, right? Go ahead, Bruno.
Yes, of course. Now there are no real strong organization. Maybe the Yellow Vest will organize because you have some, you know, public assembly, local public assembly, and out of that maybe something will happen. I don't know. We will observe, and it will be very important what happens next Saturday with manifestation in Paris. What will happen? Of course, within the leading forces, we have two tendencies, I suppose. Some of them are all obviously talking now about a state of emergency, which means refreshments, and others are, you know, tending to talk about, you know, elections, taking into account that anyway in 6 months there will be European elections. So anyway, we have a situation where it's very difficult to know what will happen. But what is important is that all official institution of and people at the occupying place in the hierarchy are delegitimized. And, you know, people don't believe anymore in the official values, in the official institutions, and in the neoliberal policies. So I don't know what it will change in the next, in the near future. But anyway, the French society will never be back to what it was 1 month ago.
Yeah, let me go to Luke, because they proved their power in numbers, okay? Yeah, I tell you, this whole Euro project is terrified of democracy. This, well, people's will, that is like, it is. It's like a plague to them, okay? They need to go back up in their little towers and lock all their gates, okay? Luke, I mean, is there a demonstration effect for the rest of Europe watching what's going on in France?
I think it is. You've seen that Belgium, Holland, even Serbia, Germany, you have yellow vests appearing. Maybe it's not a revolution like it is in France, but it is going elsewhere as well. And you said their lack of organization. It's true. They are not organized, but it is their strength, because the power in place in Paris cannot deal with them. They can't talk to people without having others saying, we deny them the authority to speak for us. So it is a strength, just like in 1789 at the French Revolution. The people were crying for bread. Now they cry for fuel, but it's only a beginning. And as you said, the liberal order is going to change profoundly. In Brussels, you cannot just simply say there are the progressives and then there are the nationalists. This doesn't work anymore, you know. And the commission can start yesterday. They announced that they would go for the fake news, like those, of course, of RT and others who are the bad guys, but nobody believes them.
There is a real trend for populism left and right. I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm going to end on this. I am so pleased that maybe finally we can start reinventing our political language, because what the mainstream media tries to do is buttonhole us, divide us. Something new is happening, and it's exciting. Let's keep our eyes open. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Paris, Brussels, and in Luxembourg. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.